Welcome to Wake Up Podcast with Viv Trader. Viv is a curious person with the desire to embrace different opinions and expertise. Her focus is health, well-being, environmental, and political. She holds a non-judgmental approach and she is objective. Viv's ambition is to raise your awareness and contribute to a better world. She is also the founder of Vivalicious Food, which produces an innovative vegan baby food with added omega-3 from an algae oil. www.vivaliciousfood.com.
So today I have the real pleasure of and honor of having you, Dr. Anna Stone, as my guest. Thank you so much for coming.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it's so nice to have you here. Anna, where are you in the world?
Well, I'm in Dartford, which is just outside London in the UK. I'm sitting in my spare bedroom that doubles as a study, talking to my computer, as we spend so much time doing nowadays.
Yeah, you're right. Now, Anna, before we start, can you please tell me a little bit about yourself? Who are you?
Well, I'm an academic, obviously. I work at the University of East London and I teach and I do research. My teaching, I focus on a number of different strands, but some of what I look at is faces and how we process faces and what's important to us about faces, and how we judge people based on their faces, because we do. We look at someone and we make an instant judgment about the kind of person they are and what they're good at based on nothing more than what they look at. And it's very strong, it's consistent, and it's often wrong, but we still do it.
That is so interesting. So from a viewpoint from psychology, why do we judge people so harshly depending on how they look?
I think there are a number of strands to that, but a lot of it may be based on our evolutionary development. If you go back hundreds of thousands of years, somebody who looked different may have had a disease. They may have had some kind of congenital deformity. Either way, they're likely to be someone you don't want to be friends with, definitely don't want to be a reproductive partner. You don't particularly want them joining your tribe. They may be carrying a disease. They may just be, you know, genetically unfit. So we are descended from people who chose good reproductive partners. And it may only be very, very weak statistical link between somebody who looks different and somebody who doesn't have the greatest genetics. But even if there's a tiny link, over hundreds of thousands of years, it shows up in evolution. So that's one possible explanation. It doesn't apply very much to why we still make these judgments now. But we're trained to make certain judgments and we're brought up making certain judgments. If you look at our culture, our films, our TV, there's a very lazy shorthand that somebody with a visible facial difference, often someone with a scar, is the bad guy. They're bitter and twisted because they have a facial difference, and that's the bad guy. And it's a lazy kind of shorthand just to say, oh, this is the bad guy because their face looks a bit different. So we get a lot of this in our culture. And in some cultures, it's explicit, the idea that some kind of a visible difference is because you were bad in a previous life. So this is your punishment. That appears sometimes as well. So there's all sorts of cultural influences as well, telling us that if somebody looks different, it might be their fault. Of course, this isn't true, but they're longstanding influences.
Is this on a subconscious level as well? They were programmed to...
Yes, I think it is subconscious. It's not something anybody does consciously. But every time you see a film with somebody with facial difference, they're the bitter, twisted person. They have emotional shortcomings, social shortcomings. They're often the bad guy. And it seeps into the consciousness. So often we've seen the idea of someone with a different face is paired with various negative attributes. It seeps into our memory. We don't consciously buy into it at all, but it's always there in background, as it were. And we can override it, but we have to make a conscious decision to override it.
What is the difference? What is a different face?
It could be anything. It could be a skin blemish. It could be someone with a birthmark or a skin condition. It could be somebody whose facial features have developed differently. It could be somebody who's acquired a scar or burn injury. There's a whole variety of things it could be. Mm. It could be a result of a facial surgery.
And I'm thinking in this society we live in today, where injections and fillers and how is that impacting our health and mental health?
Well, we live in a society in which we're all becoming much more homogenous and we all want to look the same. Nobody wants to look old. So we're all desperately trying to look younger. We're all covering up skin blemishes, as you say. We're using a lot of makeup and we're using various artificial aids to change our appearance. And we're all trying to look more and more similar to each other. So we're actually artificially shrinking the range of kinds of people that we see in everyday life. So it's becoming harder and harder to look close to the ideal. And we get less and less variety of faces that we actually see in our experience. And that's another problem, because we're accustomed to seeing people who have very standard, normal, average faces. We're unused to seeing people with different faces. So it's more of a shock when we do. But of course, some people, depending on what the problems are, if they've had some kind of injury or some congenital problem, they will go through surgery to try and, because the face is not just an appearance, it also contains organs. All your essential organs, so yeah, they need to be working. People go through a certain amount of surgery, but often they will say, no, I've had enough. I don't want to go under the knife anymore. And the surgeon will be saying, but we can still make you look more normal. And they're saying, no, no more surgery. Everything works. I'm done. So there is a pressure on us all to look the same as everybody else.
Is that weird? We are scared to be ostracized?
I think so. I think it's because we see all around us that people with faces that are conventionally attractive, they have better outcomes. People like them. They get better jobs. They get higher salaries. If you look conventionally attractive, people want to know you. They want to be your friend. They want to take you out. They want to give you a job. We've seen this all around us. We know that if you want to get ahead, it's a good idea to look a certain way. With women, you have to be conventionally feminine and attractive. With men, you have to be taller and have strong jaws and brow ridges.
Hmm. And how will this impact evolution long term?
Oh, that's an interesting question. If we don't do something about global heating, I'm not sure we have a long term. I mean, some people are saying that we have kind of broken the link with evolution, because where is it? And you don't have to go back more than a few centuries. People who had some kind of genetic weakness, they were much less likely to survive. They wouldn't be having children. But now, of course, we look after people. And so people do survive to adulthood and people do themselves have children. So it may be that certain kinds of genes are going to be more prevalent in the population than they might have been. But it's so hard to say. I mean, if you go back 100 years, people had large families, they had a lot of children, and they didn't all survive. Nowadays, people have one or two children, or none, but those they have, they do survive. So we've changed our environment in such important ways, and we've changed the way that evolution will work on our environment.
Mm. And in terms of with people looking pretty much the same, how is that with us being authentic and having the mask? It's almost like we're wearing a mask.
We are wearing a mask. We're trying to present the face that will get us ahead. And we've always known you dress up smartly for a job interview. It's what you do. Everybody knows that you dress up for a job interview. So people dress up their faces as well, because they know they will get better outcomes if they look a certain way. We are perhaps a little bit less forgiving than we might be about people who look a bit different. I mean, it's one thing if somebody comes to an interview in jeans when they could have worn a suit, but if somebody has a visible facial difference, there's little they can do about that or should do about that. And some people are saying, well, why should I cover up? This is my face. Why should I change it just because you don't like it? It's my face.
Mm. How come you got the passion to dig into this topic and this subject?
It's just a very interesting subject, how we perceive each other, you know, how we react to each other based on these very shallow physical attributes, but we do, and we do it consistently. It's a fascinating subject, and you can't get away from faces. The face is the center of interaction. When you're talking to someone, you are going to be looking at their face.
And how about eye contact?
Eye contact's important, again. Difficult on a computer, but we're having eye contact also important, but the right amount of eye contact. Too much eye contact is threatening, and it's as weird as too little eye contact. So there are fixed rules about eye contact. What's the optimum length of time to hold somebody's eyes before you really need to look away because you're making them uncomfortable? That's a whole separate subject, and it depends on who you are and who they are.
Yeah, but in terms of if you are at work and you're talking to a colleague, for instance, how long should you spend, how long should you look someone in the eye on average?
I don't recall what the figures are. I think you look for a few seconds and you look away, but it depends whether you're talking or they're talking. If I'm talking to you and I'm staring you in the eyes, that can be quite aggressive. But if you're talking and I'm looking at you, that's just polite. If you're talking and I look away, looks like I'm not paying attention, so that's quite rude. So it depends whose turn it is to talk.
So the facial expressions have a very big impact as well on the, you know, the silent language, you know.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, facial expressions are also extremely important. So that's one of the main reasons we look at somebody's face, to work out how they're feeling.
So what is a face that is very popular that people really like? What kind of attributes?
Who do we find? What faces? Well, it depends on the situation, I suppose. Depends on the situation you're in. And there are all sorts of rules about the faces we find attractive. There are certain faces that we associate with particular personality characteristics. So women, for example, if they're looking for a partner, looking for a friend or an intimate partner, are looking for different things. Looking for different things in a short-term relationship and a long-term relationship. Men typically looking for female attractiveness.
And I'm just thinking now, because quite often I actually said this to someone the other day, that when you look at couples, a lot of times couples actually look like sisters and brothers, are very similar.
Yes. There is a saying that opposites attract, and it's not true. Similarity attracts. We do end up with going out with someone of a similar background, similar values, similar kind of level of education, similar kind of income, often similar interests, and somebody who looks like us. We do tend to go out with people who look a bit like us. And you can take a bunch of couples and put them in a room and tell them all to separate and mingle, and then get somebody to come along and try and work out who's with who. And they will do better than chance at actually pairing people up, working out who's actually partnered with whom.
Wow, that is so fascinating. I mean, when you see couples and they look so similar, the body shape and the you know, they have a round face and the hair color, it's just amazing. And I guess that's to do with what we are feeling safe with, what we are used to, right? On a subconscious level as well.
I think, again, it is on an unconscious level. You can understand why people would go out with someone who's similar kind of backgrounds and values and interests. It makes it very much easier to get along. And maybe it is. Maybe when we're looking for a partner, we're looking someone who reminds us of our own family.
Mm.
Somebody who does look like our brothers and sisters and our parents, because they're safe, they're familiar, they're wholesome, they're good.
Mm. So even there, the facial look is very important as well when you're tracking your life partner, obviously, to have the similarity.
Well, some people are attracted to those who are different.
Yeah.
Just as well, really. Otherwise, our gene pool would shrink to an unhealthy level.
So this is really, really interesting. What is the most profound insight you have got from this work?
I think my most profound personal insight is to understand my own prejudices and how much I'm swayed by what people look like, and to try and see beyond that. That was quite a shock, really, when you realise your own prejudices. I mean, it's fine talking about it in general, but when you realise it's you as well, then you have to face it, really.
What did that look like for you?
It looked like a bit of it was an eye-opener. It was a... You know, I didn't beat myself up because I understood where it was coming from, but this is definitely something I need to think about. why am I judging people on their appearance? This is something I need to get control of and realize that I'm doing it and stop doing it.
And it's how long ago? Part. Yeah, it's an unconscious part. But how long ago did you sort of have the wake up?
It's been about 10 years ago now, yeah. I think. Yeah.
And was there like a very big insight for you?
It was a big insight for me. Yes, it was a big realization. But it taps into all sorts of other things like anti-racism training. That's another kind of unconscious bias, which is really problematic at the moment that we're all being invited to come to grips with.
Yeah, let's talk about that. What is happening with racism today? Where are we at?
Oh, gosh. It's again, we're I think, scratching the surface. We're all agreed that we have a problem. We need to do something. Well, most people agree we have a problem. We need to do something about it. But we need to do a lot more thinking, I think, a lot more understanding where our biases come from. It's easier to tackle a problem if you know what its source is. So I'd like to see more perhaps philosophical work in understanding what it is. Is it fear of the other? Is it fear that motivates us? What is it that we're actually experiencing? And is it fear of someone who looks different, or is it fear of somebody's different culture? What is it that we're worried about? Are we worried that they have different values to us? Where is this coming from? I'd like to see some more work being done on that. And I'd like to understand how racism interacts with other aspects of life as well, how it interacts with the class structure and class hierarchies, how it interacts with class background, because I think there's a big issue there, understanding what's race and what's class and how they interact with each other.
Yeah. Do you see there's a lot more like poverty?
Poverty does affect people from ethnic minorities more than majorities in their own country. Yes, that's undoubtedly true. So what we're seeing is children who come from, you know, under-resourced backgrounds. Are they failing in school because the teachers are racist, or are they failing in school because they come from under-resourced backgrounds?
Yeah.
And I don't think we understand enough of where these unconscious biases are coming from.
And that comes with so many other problems like hunger, starvation, yes. Malnutrition.
Yeah, yeah. Malnutrition, kids who can't go to school because they haven't got a school uniform, or come to school and they haven't had any breakfast. Yes, it affects a lot of things like that. Yes, yeah. It's true that ethnic minorities are more likely to be clustered in very under-resourced backgrounds. That's true.
And that's a massive problem because what will that lead to in the future if we don't look after the children?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? If we're not looking after our children, what are we doing? What is going to happen in the future? These are very, very big questions. We've strayed a bit from our original topic, but it's all very interesting stuff. Yes. I have to look after your children. There's nothing more important than looking after the children.
And why do I can't understand why there is such a big problem looking after the children. I mean, it should be a human right to not be hungry when you're a child in school.
I don't know why. I detect a mood of helplessness, perhaps. We see these problems around us, but we think, oh, we can't do anything about it. You know, when we're not a rich country, we can't do anything about it. We are a rich country, and yes, we can do something about it. It's not rocket science, but most people are working to do something about it. We just haven't got the whole country pulling together yet. We did have programs to look after children from under-resourced backgrounds in schools. But budgets got cut, and I'm thinking, why are you cutting the budgets from the schools? That doesn't make any sense at all. Cut the budgets from less essential programs, but don't cut the budgets from the schools. But
yeah, and I think with the political work that's being done, you know, when you look at health, it's always the short-term economic winning that is the most important aspect when you look at health, right? And since politicians only sit for it's like 4 years, then they're out. It has to be some sort of more long-term planning ahead and perhaps change the values and priorities.
Yes, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Short-termism is definitely an issue. And it comes up in all sorts of ways. A lot of what we're doing to the environment is for short-term benefit, for definitely for long-term disbenefit, which again is a way in which we're not looking after our children. We're not leaving the planet to our children in the state it was in when we found it. And again, for short-term decisions. I guess the answer is people are individually selfish. We can pull together as a society, but we need everyone in society to be pulling together, which means there have to be sanctions on people who don't. And it's always the argument, why should I pay my taxes if my neighbour doesn't pay their taxes? We need to know everybody's paying their fair share of taxes, and then we're all happy. Yeah, I'm really happy to pay more taxes if it gets spent on health and education, but I want to know that other people are paying their taxes as well. We want to know that we're all pulling together as a society.
And perhaps being more conscious and working from our hearts instead of our minds.
We need to work from both, don't we?
Yeah.
We need the hearts and the minds. We need the logic and we need the values to come together as well. I mean, we have to know what our values are, or we don't even know what solutions we're looking for. But we also have to be sensible about picking the right solutions. Yeah. Logic and values, they need to come together.
So we have actually a massive problem with values. We don't know what our values are today. Something's gone wrong there. Is that correct?
I know what our values are. I think people, by and large, they know very much what their values are. And we all agree on common values. For some reason, we've lost our hope, we've lost our optimism, we've lost our sense that as a society, as a country, we can pull together and make our values stick. I think we agree on a lot more things than we disagree on. And often when we disagree, people are disagreeing because they're in possession of some very strange alternative facts that they've read on the internet. And they're really, really widely uninformed of what the actual situation is.
Very interesting. Right. So what's been your biggest fear in your life?
I've had a lot of fears over my life, and I think they change as you age and get older. I suppose my biggest fear is not so much for myself anymore. And again, I think this is something that happens when you pass 60, your biggest fears are not for yourself anymore. They're more for the world you're leaving behind. And that would be my biggest fear. It would be for the world we're leaving behind, because we are not leaving the planet in the state it was when we found it. Global heating is very real. This year has just been insane for weather catastrophes. The floods and the wildfires all over Europe have been. I don't know what it's like for you in Sweden, if you've had
it's been insane. We have had so much rain, and don't really? Talk about the mosquitoes. Mosquitoes, it's been horrible. I mean, even with mosquito spray, it's just been almost impossible to be outside. They've been really aggressive, they've been biting you for your clothes, and it's been a nightmare.
That's awful. Been to Stockholm a couple of times, a beautiful city, but the mosquitoes.
Not all spots in Sweden. Some spots have sort of managed to not have mosquitoes, but where I am, it's been this massive invasion. And of course, all the mosquito spray is sold out. And it's been problematic for the children as well, because, you know, when they do the sports, they get bitten, you know, they play the soccer and football. And yeah, so it has been a very odd year with lots of storms, more than usual.
More than usual storms. I mean, in the UK, we're just incredibly lucky. We don't get the massive extremes of temperature that other places do. We're wet enough not to have really bad wildfires, you know.
Yeah,
if it doesn't rain for a month, we say it's a drought, but technically it is. But no, we are very, very lucky climate wise but even so, we're seeing more floods and wildfires that we've not seen in the past.
So in terms of climate heating, what do you think we need to do? Like, what is the point of action, the urgency that needs to be taken?
The urgency is very much now. And this comes back to what we were saying earlier. I think by and large, people do know what needs doing. There are still a small number of climate change deniers, but they're increasingly few in number. We can just ignore them and pass laws anyway. But we need firm government action. Individual people driving a bit less, eating a bit less red meat, that's not going to make enough difference. We need concerted action as a society, and that means government action. Massive subsidies for renewable energy, solar panels on every roof. I can't understand why people are still building new houses without solar panels. How come that hasn't been compulsory 20 years ago? We need massive government action, vast investment in public transport, get the cars off the road. Again, some people will hate not being able to use their cars, and they'll complain about losing their freedoms. And I'm thinking, freedom's nothing if you're dead. This is actually real. We need to make big changes, but they need to be centrally driven. They need to be government action, which is not happening right now.
No, I was going to say, how is that going on in the UK? What's the progress there with the environmental...
It's been pretty bad under Conservative government. They've approved a lot of licenses to drill for oil and gas in the North Sea. And there's a virtual ban on onshore wind turbines. It's been impossible to erect onshore wind turbines for several years. They've now made that slightly less impossible, but it's still much too difficult. There are barriers in the way of renewables and subsidies being thrown at the carbon energy sources. It's insane.
Hmm.
We're going in the wrong direction at the moment.
Yeah. With that, where do you hope we are in 10 years from now?
10 years from now, I would hope we've seen a very, very widespread change in the way people live their lives and the actual texture of their lives, from the notions that you don't have to drive everywhere. Active transport, people walking, people cycling, people using a lot more local resources in their own neighbourhood. So people are actually improving their own neighbourhoods so that they can do the things they want to do locally and not have to drive everywhere. So the idea of the 15-minute city, where everything you need for a decent life is within 15 minutes, you have access to green spaces, access to leisure facilities, access to transport and shops and doctors and things within 15 minutes, the notion of the 15-minute city. And we'll all value our communities a lot more because we'll be spending a lot more of our time with our community, in our local communities, with our neighbours. And we found that happening during the pandemic and lockdowns, and it was really good. And
oh,
then
really?
We have lockdown and people stopped. And I'm thinking, no, let's get back to where that was. We all talked to our neighbours a lot more and we looked after each other a lot more. And it was really good.
Yeah, so you, I totally agree with you. I live in a small community and it's lovely, you know. How is that on a psychological point of view for us to live in a big city versus living in a smaller community? What's the difference there? On the quality of our lives.
Yeah, we are learning a lot about what actually matters to the quality of our lives. And what matters is social connections. And what matters is access to greenery and open space. It's very psychologically healthy to spend time out of doors, tree bathing, forest bathing, being near water, just being near greenery and under trees. It's extremely good for us psychologically. But too many people don't live within easy walking distance of any outdoor green space. So that's not good. And social contact and social connections, they're really, really important for our mental health as well.
Mm.
Money is not important to mental health, unless you're so poor that it's constant stress. Once you've got enough money for a decent life, more money is not going to make you any happier.
Just more meaningful connections. Yeah,
meaningful connections and meaningful activities as well, to do something you believe in. It doesn't have to be paid work. It could be voluntary work. It could be looking after your family or your local community. But to do something you actually believe in, that's important too.
Comes back to our values, right?
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. It comes back to our values. We don't always understand the things that make us actually happy and healthy. And if we did, I think our values would change.
Lovely. So we all need to get to know each other. Self-love, explore yourself, get to know yourself, tap into your passions, what makes you tick.
Your passions, definitely. Give something back. It makes you feel better when you give something to other people.
Mm. And give something doesn't have to be materialistic. It can be a nice gesture. It can be a nice word, a compliment.
It could just be smiling at someone. It can be holding the door for them. It can just be, you know, giving a friendly wave to the driver who's just cut you up. They're probably having a bad day. Give them a smile and a wave. You may reset their day for them. it's being a bit more generous to everybody around us.
Yeah.
And making time to get out into nature.
Yeah.
We're really absolutely starting to understand how important that is.
Yeah. Very grounding.
Very grounding. And spend less time in the office.
Mm.
Definitely less time in the office.
Mm. Very, very wise words and very clever strategies that everyone can amplify anytime, really.
Yeah. I think so.
Yeah. Is there anything else?
You probably know this already, don't you? Do you think
I just been for a run before I came on with you in forest. So, and I live in nature by water. So I'm very mindful and you try to.
Yes.
And I know, I lived in London. I lived in big cities as well. So I done that too. I love where I live. It's nice. It's very nice to know your neighbors and look out for each other. And
yes, you know,
mm-hmm.
Yes, it
makes a big difference. Is there anything else, Anna, you'd like to add to the people out there as a final word?
Not really. I think, as you said it yourself, get in touch with yourself. You know what really makes you happy. You actually do. Stop letting other people tell you what you should look like and what you should spend your money on. They don't know you, so ignore them. Switch off the adverts. You look like what you look like. And learn to love yourself.
Mm. Thank you so much. It was a real honor to have you here today. I really enjoyed myself.
Thank you, Viv. It was lovely to meet you.
I hope you got some valuable information today. Wake up, wake up. And thanks for checking in and waking up. See you next time.